Strap in, operatives. This is Go Back, your all-access pass to modern-day RPGs, loaded with bullets, backstories, and a whole lot of bad decisions. And here are your mission leaders, Sean and Harrigan.
Hey, Harrigan, here we are. Another episode of Go Bag.
Good morning, Sunshine.
Good morning, sir.
Time to get on the mics.
Dust it off. Talk about Delta Green yet again.
Yeah, this is season 2, episode 5. Is that right?
That's right.
Cool. Yeah, we continue our press into the Delta Green, the world of Delta Green, the RPG. And I think we're making good progress. I think we've covered a few things so far that we wanted to, and there's a few more that remain. So I think we're keep on trucking. There's lots of content in this game to explore, man.
Yeah, I'm excited about this one.
Today's?
I think so.
Should be good.
I believe so, yeah. Otherwise, the infamous intro question, what go-bagging have you been doing?
I am sad to say, I think I can officially state none this week. I just haven't been doing espionage game stuff. I've been doing too much work shit. I've been doing prep for the show. I've been doing this, that, the other thing, but I have not consumed media, played games, run games. There's one thing I think I'll mention it in the sit rep that I didn't mention before. I'll bring that up, but it's minor league stuff, but nothing dedicated, I'm afraid to say. What about you?
Same. Although, I mean, part of it got a little sidetracked due to Star Trek Adventures that you and I are participating in with our every other Thursday night group. Although I would say that there might be an element of covert action in that game.
I was just going to say, it's hard when you're not like monogamous gamers, like, because we aren't, right? Like, we like a lot of different stuff. Both Sean and I obviously love espionage and covert action games. We both love Delta Green. But that's not the only types of RPGs that we run, play, read about, buy, research, etc. So it's been a challenge to try and keep things balanced. But I had the same thought you did, where we've even talked about either an episode or a couple of episodes around covert action blending in with some other genres kind of thing, like science fiction, like cyberpunk. And indeed, you can even have some Star Trek Adventures covert action episodes for sure.
Yeah, so that would be the closest thing to that. Tonight I have a Delta Green game. The other, every 2 weeks I play with the face to face group, and it might not happen again tonight. Like last time, we kind of shot the shit for a few hours just to talk, and then this week, due to other, personal and business stuff, I don't know if we'll get to the table again this week, which will be unfortunate. But I did drop my buddy Jeff. I'm like, hey, man, kind of thinking of a duet game. Kind of my way of making it up to him and seeing if he might be interested in that. But I think it's going to be an online component, and I don't know if that's really what his preference is, and that's
not his jam.
He may just say, well, just come on over and and I'm like, well, it's kind of the reason why I want to do it this way. So we'll see.
Since I think you know this by now, but online, the pros and cons, but one of the pros is that you can play for like 90 minutes or 2 hours. And especially if it's a small group, you can get stuff done. And that way you can like meet twice a week. If you have time in your schedule,
right.
It's kind of a different pacing to the whole once a month play for 8 hours or twice a month play for 4 hours, right? It's just a different way to kind of package it.
I mean, as we talk about some of the topics of Delta Green, I'm like, man, there would be some things that I could throw at him as a single agent. And then if he gets an additional agent to accompany him, like you did with Dirigible and his, your guys' duet game, I don't have to worry about two other people at the table being bored.
Correct.
It's all spotlight, one person, like whatever it is that's happening, you have full reign and control. You have full reign and control, in Delta Green, but
you have no control.
You have no control. It's all an illusion.
Yeah. I have loved that format for many, many years. And in fact, one of the reasons, you know, you mentioned Dirigible, he and I started playing play-by-post games, I think in like 2003 or four or something, like a long time ago. He was a kid. He's quite a bit younger than I am. And one of the things that we did was we fell into a lot of the same, like, we liked the certain types of superhero games, the certain types of fate games. And we even ended up playing what I then called a solo game, which meant a solo PC, one GM, one PC, now called a duet, you know, popularly. We played many of those types of games over the years, specifically for the reasons you're getting at. Like, and especially in, you can picture play by post because you were one of the problem children. Sometimes people lose track of the fact that they're in a game. They don't post very often. They kind of slow everything down. So play by post games are very vulnerable to like the group dynamic. If everybody's not on the same page in terms of pace, in terms of tone, in terms of like what we're trying to accomplish. Well, when you narrow that down to one player and the GM who know each other, or like you and Jeff knowing each other, man, it can sing. It can really be a cool experience because you don't have to do as much spotlight shifting, as much I'm concerned that someone else is part of the group and wants to play, but isn't getting the same level of enjoyment because they're not investing as much and they don't want to. Well, if you play with the one dude who's so into it, he reskins the RPG with new art and new covers like Jeff does, you can be sure he's pretty into it, right?
Yeah. So we'll see. That's what I got going on my end. That's it.
Cool. I'm glad to hear that you're a little inspired by the kind of the one-on-one aspect. I think those can be very fun games.
Yeah.
I'm kind of going the other way. So I've got the game I'm playing right now on Gamers Playing, the single, that one player Delta Green game, maybe isn't enough for me for Delta Green, because part of the issue that Dirigible and I have also had is that sometimes we're slow posters in those games because they tend to be meatier posts, deeper sort of stories. So it takes time, right? There's a number of new people who have just joined the site, and several of them are like, hey, Delta Green's my favorite game. So I've kind of got an eyebrow up, like, maybe I want to get a little Delta Green thing going, a little shotgun scenario. There's a couple of ones I have in mind that would be run pretty quickly for some new players kind of thing. So that may be getting off the ground the next, I don't know, month or two, something like that.
Very cool.
Yeah. We should sit the rep.
Let's do that.
Give me the sit rep.
Sit rep. This week, really only have one that I was going to reference. I was telling Harrigan as we talk about in this episode, which, you know, spoilers, we're going to get into combat and tradecraft. And there's an important document that's out there that some Delta Green heads probably have in their library and have dispersed to players. And that's Alphonse's Axioms for Agents, or Agent Alphonse's Axioms for Agents. It's not an Unspeakable Oath. Adam Scott Glancy put it out there, and it's like 44 pieces of information that give this to your players for them to understand and kind of embrace what Delta Green is about. You know, for example, one of the points is always lie to anybody outside Delta Green. Always tell the truth to anyone inside Delta Green. And it goes into a lot of those details, which coincide with a few things about tradecraft, I would say.
Yeah, for sure. It's a fantastic document. One of the problems Delta Green has, I think, lines up with the same way that people say they have an easier time playing a fantasy game rather than a science fiction game, because science fiction games means there's all these unknowns that everybody has to agree on. Like, is there anti-gravity? Are there aliens? Is there AI? Right? Where if you're not on the same page, people can be playing kind of very different games in their own head. Delta Green, I think, suffers from a similar thing where people who don't know any of the sort of covert ops, espionage, action, the tropes, the methods, you know, and I mean, you and I don't know them, but we know of them. We watch them in movies. We read about them in books, right? Delta Green can kind of be a bit of a brick wall for people who are like, I don't know how to play an agent who's going to be doing investigations. And I think that this document, the same way the documents we mentioned a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about character generation, there's these additional materials that really help sort of flesh it out. This is that in spades for like being a player in the game.
Yeah.
I think it gives you some great guidelines.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool. I came up with a quick one while we were sitting here that I forgot about. It's been posted in the BS Landia Discord. The laundry is now, I think, on the street for backers at least. Maybe it's in stores. I don't know. But the Charles Stross novels that have turned into an RPG, the RPG is now like, it's out there. It's coming soon if you haven't seen it yet, which is kind of the, you know, the slightly farcical agency that tackles cosmic horror stuff. Were you telling me this? I don't remember either. I can't remember where I saw this or read it, but Charles Stross apparently has written some serious cosmic horror as well, and didn't like how it made him feel. Like, so he switched gears to do like this lighter in tone, slightly tongue-in-cheek kind of stuff, which is The Laundry.
Laundry, second edition, I believe. I think it's like, it has been out before.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think this is a new second edition or a new edition with a new system. Like something's different about it.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it was crowdfunded and now out. Mm-hmm. Now, I say this because I think it's by Catalyst Games. I think they're the publisher, if I'm not mistaken.
Maybe.
Yeah, I think that's my brain trying to work that back. It intrigued me at first glance reading, like, I didn't know it existed prior, and people were like, yay, The Laundry's coming back. And, you know, I'm like, what the hell is this all about? And I read the premise and I'm like, oh, cool. And then I read further and went, oh, farcical. Like, I did not list this in the links, but I think Dark Conspiracy is making a comeback. And I brought that up on a Saturday stream and I called you out, man, specifically to that. So I know that's coming. For those that are Delta Green fans and some of the Covert Black Men in, that is like the Men in Black, is my understanding, type of game. So
gotcha. Yeah. I had the exact same reaction. And I, you know, I'll admit I had not read the books, but when I first saw The Laundry, I was like, ooh, I'm talking the second edition, the recent Kickstarter, right? Or backer kit, whatever the hell it was. And then I read more and I'm like, just, it's just not for me. I just want the grim, the troubled, the dark version of this.
Paranoia, the game, is a fine game. People rave about it all the time, but I don't find...
Sometimes people also rage about it, if you remember correctly.
That's true.
From the Game Hole a couple of years ago.
That's true. <They're...
laughs> Inside joke.
Yes.
I was raging.
Yes, the Harrigan would be the rager. But I find like, oh, I've never played Paranoia. And they're like, Sean, you never played Paranoia? Nope, haven't played Paranoia, but I have owned it. And it was like a later edition. I have all a bunch of PDFs from a bundle from a previous edition. And I think it would be fun as a con game or a, you know, two session streak, but it's not something that intrigues me long term. So when I talk about The Laundry, I'm like, maybe, but if it's too farcical, I'm just not. Dude, I don't fire up Austin Powers when I want to watch a covert action game.
I don't either, but I appreciate Austin Powers and Get Smart for what they are.
Yes,
and,
you know, of course.
All of the Naked Gun stuff and like all those
Naked Gun classic, yeah.
I bet The Laundry would be awesome as a one-shot at a con game with some buds. Like, I think you'd have a hoot. You'd have a great time.
Agreed.
I will also say, though, and this kind of gets to my experience. I mean, my experience with Paranoia at that one con was not great for a variety of reasons. It was a super loud room. There were like 8 or 9 players at the table. There were 2 GMs or a GM and a co-GM. There was just so much going on. It was one of those situations, you know, I won't go into it, but one of those situations where some players, just because they couldn't like engage and hear properly, they weren't playing the game, kind of. And others were dominating because they knew the game. They knew what all the different like alert levels meant and all that kind of stuff, right? And I was not among them. But I will reveal a bias. I mean, you've played games with me. I love humor in games, Sean. I do not love games that are supposed to be funny and where everyone is trying to be funny. And that is like I don't like Toon. I don't like Paranoia. It's something about it rubs me the wrong way. I want that stuff to emerge naturally. Like if we play Green Oaks, that game will be a freaking riot, right? This is the retiree.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
But we're not going to go in with, I don't know. There's a different vibe I get from games that are, like, I didn't back the Monty Python game either, the recent Monty Python game.
I watch the movies.
Like, I love Monty Python. Yeah. But I don't know, man. Maybe I'm wrong on some of this stuff, but I've always had less than thrilling experiences when I'm sitting down with a group of people who are all kind of trying to outdo each other in terms of how funny they are and the jokes they tell and all that kind of stuff. So
I have had players want to be the stand-up comedian in the group. And it, like, dude, it gets old really fast. And I'm like, reel it back. Not everything that happens in this RPG turns into like this punchline for some reason. So I can empathize, and I am similar. I haven't played Toon, but it, to your point, it's very much a like, if it's on the menu and I'm going to play it once at a con or, you know,
100%
and go bonkers. Sure. But do I want to put it on my shelf and go, oh, I really need to get this to the table and run it all the time? Nah.
Compare and contrast that with both, and forgive us for the inside baseball stuff here, guys, but with the outgunned game that Digital Hobbit ran, which was hilarious, but those games don't have to be hilarious.
No.
And with the Turbo Breakers game, the World of Dungeons Turbo:Breakers game that Wayne ran around sort of, you know, modern day special forces kind of dungeon delving type of stuff. Also like ridiculously over the top and funny and just so good, but they don't start off with like, you know, a bunch of comedians at the table and, you know, trying to write better jokes at each other kind of thing, you know? I don't know. What are you smiling about?
I'm just thinking of the Breakers game and I played Jason Hobbs. Or no, I called him, what is it like something like Jacob Shobbs or something?
Yeah,
the
something
floor
like
repair
that.
Guy.
Yes.
Floor salesman.
Yes.
So yeah. If you don't know who Jason Hobbs is from Hobbs and Friends of the OSR and Hobbs and Friends, that's I played him as a character and it was a joke. And, you know, anyways, that was.
So we need to lean on Wayne because he's going to Game Hole this year.
Yes, he is.
And we can do a redux of that team.
We can. Yeah. So anyways.
Anyway.
Little insight into Harrigan and I's outside the go bag. Outside the bag. Hey.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
We don't have any encrypted comms this week that was of note or had come through. So I think we can skip that and get straight into the mission brief.
As of this recording, you and I right now, it's April 12th today where we're recording. We don't have the first episode of season 2 up live on the podcatchers, do we?
We don't have any episodes up live at this point.
What does that mean? You took season 1 down?
Oh, I'm sorry. Season 1 is... I'm sorry. Season 2, we do not have any. Season 2...
That's what I thought.
Season 1 is all out there in audio, and we're slowly releasing them on YouTube as I think I queued up 4 video versions of our episodes from season 1 to be out.
Especially the ones that are appropriate to be video, that sort of thing.
Right.
I gotcha. Yeah. My point is for encrypted comms, we haven't released the beginning of the Delta Green season yet, so I'm not surprised that there's no action.
Right. Right? Yes.
Yeah. The radio waves are quiet.
Yes.
Cool.
The audience thinks we are off.
Yes. It's vanished into the ether. Yes.
So now when we drop all these, we'll be like done with the season as people talk about Delta Green.
And it'll be way, and oh, they'll be writing in about stuff that we won't remember because we're both old with terrible memories.
We'll get into the next season, which we probably won't.
In season 1 or episode 1, you talked about, did I say that? Right,
yeah. Yes.
I don't remember.
You actually, I'm waiting for the actuallys to come through. So
there'll be some.
Yes.
I think we've already proven as people get through these Delta Green episodes, we've proven we are not the experts in this stuff.
Yes.
We just like it.
Yes. You know? We're becoming experts.
Sure. If you say so.
Let's get into mission brief.
Have a seat. Let's get on with the mission brief.
Combat and tradecraft. Chocolate and peanut butter. Sometimes. I'm going to tackle combat, and then my esteemed colleague will get into tradecraft, and we'll banter and inject each other's opinions and comments.
Who's he? Have I met him? He sounds great.
I know. Newsflash.
Yeah, this won't be Harrigan in the rest of the episode. It'll be someone else. Oh, my.
All right.
Yes, combat and tradecraft. I mean, part of what we're trying to do here is we're not trying to plow through every page of the book by any means, but we're trying to look at the different chunks of it that matter to people who decide on a system or want to pitch the system to their players or learn about it. And we felt like, you know, we don't need a full episode on combat or tradecraft, so let's put it together and have that delicious sandwich.
Yes. Yes. And I was telling Harrigan before we hit record, I'm like, you know, I like Harrigan's approach to some of the topics. Obviously, it's very much more conversational and how he kind of presents it, where I'm more, you know, going through step by step on how sanity works. And I think that's important to some degree, but how I mean, and I've admitted to Harrigan, I'm like, if I listen to myself present that, I'd probably put myself to sleep.
You're being too hard on yourself, man.
And that may be. But regardless, in this one, combat, a little more, this will be, in my humble opinion, it'll be, I thought it would be quick. Harrigan's like, nah, it's not going to be 10 minutes, but we'll see.
You got different approach, huh? You're going to sing a song? Are you going to do some, get a whiteboard and do some strategic drawings to convey it?
I was thinking maybe.
Write a poem?
You know, a haiku maybe, perhaps.
Okay. All right.
But combat, obviously. Conflict resolution's always big in tabletop role-playing games. And the biggest one that always bubbles up to the top as far as frequency is usually the combat component, depending on the game that you are playing. Delta Green is not absent. But I would say in Delta Green, there is a saying, if guns get pulled out in Delta Green, people die. So it is very lethal. It is not the focus of this game. It's not a tactical combat game, as some people might find appealing in other popular tabletop role-playing games. But it does happen. So having said that, keeping in mind, it is deadly. You don't want combat to typically happen. Just like we mentioned, real-life simulationist, you don't, like a gun gets pulled, bullets hurt people in this world. And it's not like a couple hit points of damage. Like literally one shot could kill an agent. So it's something to keep in mind as we go through this. But essentially, the combat sequence is very simple and straightforward. It's actually, I think, sometimes even more complex as you read the rules. But it's, in a nutshell, hey, I'm gonna start. There's a surprise. Otherwise, it falls to Dex for the initiative on who begins, if there is a question. So it's a little interesting because some people will say, wow, we don't roll? No, it's whoever has the highest dexterity score goes first in order, highest to lowest. And then it stays. Go ahead.
I would wind back even slightly further and just say it's a very trad BRP combat round type system, right? You have combat rounds. Everyone takes their turn.
Yes.
And you go, you know, round one, round two, round three, round four. This is not like a play by Power by the Apocalypse game where you follow the fiction and there's no, this is super trad in terms of how the combat rounds roll out. And to your point a minute ago, what I would say is, me personally, I always want my RPGs. I don't play cozy RPGs. I think I could probably have some fun with them at some point, but I want conflict in my games. I don't have to have combat in my games. And this is one of those things where Delta Green should be filled with tension, should be filled with peril, should be filled with mystery and revelation, terrible revelation. And when combat happens, like it is going to happen, right? There's like, let's put it this way. One of the things that they talk about in the books as well is that you should not be encountering the unnatural too often, which means a lot of the antagonists are human. A lot of those things you run up against, they may not even be people who know about, you know, the conspiracy or the unnatural, but they're problematic and you have to deal with them because they're off the rocker or whatever, right? So combat will absolutely happen, but it's just not something that you can fall back to like D&D where it's like this is the default mode for problem solving. If you do that, you're going to get dead. Like it's that simple. Even without guns, it's pretty dangerous. And the flip side of that though, Sean, is it's one of the reasons I like this system a lot is if you apply like critical thinking to real combat scenarios, like set up an ambush, make sure you have enough ammunition, put somebody on the roof so they can cover the door. All that stuff plays out in this game in a way that's better than roll initiative and take your order, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. No, like the GM will factor in everything you're doing. So you can set it up so that you have the odds with you. God help you, as we saw in Impossible Landscapes for that one scene, Sean, in the mall, where the odds are against you, you're done. You're cooked. Like we got blasted in that scene. Anyway, I don't want to interrupt you too much, but it's very traditional combat. Sean's going to go through the guts of it, but there's some elements that I think make it bubble to the surface. There's a bit more going on here that makes it quite fun, actually, as well.
Yeah. Thank you for that, by the way.
Sure.
once initiative is determined, obviously it goes player by player. And the unique thing is that you only get one action. One. It's not one action, not one move action, not a major action and a minor action. It's one action per turn. And those actions include aim, attack, called shot, disarm, dodge, escape, fight back, move, pin, wait to act later. Some would say defer. And then anything else that requires some type of concentration. So that has a catch-all for ones that weren't previously listed. But most of the times they're going to fill in some of those. Now, on your turn, you can wait till your turn. But if you are fired upon because the baddie gets the drop on you, you can react to that out of order. So you can basically attempt to defend yourself. But by defending yourself, you are taking your one action for that combat sequence or for that combat round. So when you do that, you usually pick two things that you have to do when you're doing that defending piece, which is dodging or fighting back. So dodging, use your dodge skill. It is an opposed roll. Both of these will be an opposed roll, which dodge allows you to run up to 20 meters to reach cover, and it's purely defensive, which means that when you dodge, that's the deal. That's what you're hoping to achieve, is get out of the line of fire, ideally, and get behind some cover, which is huge, because then you get into cover space and
put some minus 20s on the other side, right?
Penalties and bonuses. So when you talk about combat with the book, and you're talking about having a bonus or a penalty for shooting somebody, it's usually at a plus 20, minus 20 increments as an overall whole, and not getting into those nuances entirely. But, you know, hey, I'm right there. Person's in front of me. They're defenseless. Yeah, you get a plus 20. Yeah, point blank. There's also a rule about point blank. But essentially, because of the lethality piece of combat, it would behoove you, especially if they've got the drop on you, to dodge, like seek cover, like big, it's a big deal. I don't want to get shot. Shocker, right? Like, what? I'm not going to rush in like with machine gun fire, you know, as an agent who may not be like a military based individual or any individual for that matter, which is important. So there's the dodge piece. And then we mentioned the fighting back piece. So fighting back is typically used with melee weapons, melee combat, and unarmed combat skills. So the skills involved are melee weapons and or unarmed combat skill. So again, opposed role. The difference between dodge and fighting back is that you are typically in a struggle, right? The person has a knife, they're going to fight you. Maybe it's a pin type of attack that they have on you. So you declare an offensive action to complement your fighting back. So those offensive actions that you're able to do when fighting back include the attack, called shot, disarm, and pin. And obviously for called shot, gotta have a missile weapon in your hand. Like, you gotta have a gun. Otherwise, how is that even gonna work, right? Now, if you win...
I don't know if that's true. Can you not, like, do a called shot to someone's eye or something like that?
With, like, a poke in the eye, Three Stooges way? That's a good question. I don't know. I think the knife you might be able to. I don't know if it's strictly two missile weapons.
I'll look it up as you carry on here.
Fair enough. If you win, you know, you roll opposed checks. Whoever has the highest wins or lowest wins. The attacker's attack does nothing to you, right? It's rendered useless. And it defends against the attacker, obviously, that targets you that turn. But your offensive piece that I mentioned it takes place and has an effect, but it's only against that single target. So if you're being targeted by multiple opponents and you're going to fight back, it's only fighting back against the one individual that you're really tangled up with. So you're aware. and it's a of your choice. And it's typically going to be within the narrative, right? If you're if Harrigan and I are tussling on the ground and there's other people that are involved in a barroom brawl, your target of choice is typically the one that you're up in, you're entangled with.
So I'm pretty sure you can do a called shot with unarmed as well. Like if someone has body armor on and you want to punch them only in the face,
okay,
kind of thing. It allows you to like roll grenades into like small places. You have to do a called shot because it's a small target. There's a few things like that are kind of going on. But since I'm interrupting, can I continue my interruption?
Please.
And this is why I said it wouldn't be 10 minutes. So one of the foundation stones, I don't know if we've said here, is like it's the roll under percentile system we've described before. So when someone shoots at you, if they are competent or attacks you, you know, hand to hand, if they, as long as they're not, you know, not the average Joe on the street, but somebody who's either a different agent or a cop or someone like that, they're generally going to have like a 40 to 60% chance to succeed. And without the stuff that Sean's talking about for fighting back and dodging, it could turn into more of the classic I swing, you swing, my turn, your turn, my turn, your turn, especially since the dex order doesn't change, right? So if Sean has dex 10, I have dex 9, Sean always goes first. So he goes, I go, he goes, I go, he goes, I go. Can get kind of stale. Well, when you throw in the fact that you can wait till a later action, that you can fight back, that you can dodge, it mixes the combat up enough, I think, that it starts to make it really interesting. So, for example, if you have the best dex of all and you don't know if you should shoot, like put it this way, and I've been in this situation. I think I had a higher dex. I decided to shoot back and I got the shit shot out of me because I couldn't dodge because I had used my action to shoot. What I probably should have done was wait to see what the opposition is doing, who they're shooting at. And if you need to burn a dodge then because someone puts their sights on you, you can. And if they don't, then you can take your shot, right? There's a lot of nuance around that stuff. And I really like fight back, I think, is a brilliant mechanic where it turns into this, not this like, you know, bad movie style of guy takes a swing and now it's clearly the other person's turn to take a swing. It turns into this like clench fracas, this just, you know, all bets are off. You're getting into it with the person to see who can put the other person on the floor or whatever. And the fact that you're making these opposed roles to see who can do it, best embodied for me, Sean, was the couple of combats we did have with my marshal in Impossible Landscapes against a cop in one case. And I forget who the other guy was, one of the like special forces dudes near the truck, if I'm remembering correctly. But I just remember it being very visceral because of the fact that, you know, it was these one opposed role after another. You can get hurt. When you attack somebody, you can get hurt if they fight back. I like that mechanic generally in games. Really like the fact that there's additional risk to putting yourself sort of in harm's way. And Delta Green has a pretty cool way of doing that. There's a weird rhythm you can get into where you have to keep fighting back. And as soon as you fight back, you can't do anything else. Right. So you're sort of stuck in the combat, but that's also pretty realistic. It's pretty cool. Anyway, sorry to interrupt you, but those are two parts of the game, the fighting back and the dodging and whatnot. And the fact that you can wait. I do not love the dex order not changing, but I can deal with it because it has these other parts of the game that let you to shift things around a little bit.
Yeah, and I have to think that that was part of the thing. Like, do we want people to have to re-roll every time or reset that initiative or roll for initiative? Because I think the big thing about combat in Delta Green is typically somebody is going to pull a gun or a weapon or they're going to hide behind a door. And that is initiative, period, surprise round. Especially if the other person isn't expecting it. And I would say in Delta Green, this scenario is probably more likely than everybody seeing eye to eye in a room and you're not sure who really pulls the weapon first or how they defend each other, which is, I think, really assumed in other role-playing games like D&D, right? Once it's then into the order, then it's just who can react the quickest, which is typically the case anyway, right? If you're fast... Yep. And it's combat, there is a component of that. So let's just keep that and use it. And then it could go into those rounds. And then the fact that you can defend or like it's your turn. Maybe it's not your turn. You're being attacked, but you can do something. Oh, okay. So it's not wait until my turn. Can I defend myself? Well, no, it's not your turn yet. it's kind of pretty, ridiculous in that regard for other RPGs. So with this one, you can. I mean, there are other ones that you can do defense and to defend and, increase your bonus or partial defense and all that other stuff. But I don't know. I like it and how it facilitates what it's trying to do in combat in a contemporary RPG.
It's fast. It's deadly.
Yes.
It's not hard to understand if you're new to the system. This is not a combat system that's hard to grok. After you get through a couple of combats, you'll have it down.
Now there are things to elaborate on and get into detail about, like when a person's using armor and how does that play a role in like resolving the damage or things of that nature. There's areas of effect if you're throwing grenades around, and of course those come into play, which have to do with like the +20, -20% chance, and then reducing damage and things of that nature. And then the cover component. So if you're behind cover, how much cover also plays a role into whether you're going to get hit, which is usually a penalty, or a bonus to you as the target. But the other thing that I wanted to bring up, which I think is also very Delta Green, is the lethality rating that some weapons have.
So basically, they reserve it for the more dangerous firearms, really. So if you have like a 9mm and, it's just a semi-auto, you're not going to have a lethality rating. I think that does 1d10 or 1d12, I forget which. In other words, it does a lot of damage. It can do a lot of damage. And I like the fact that it's a single die, which makes it a little swingier, right? Like you're just as likely to get a low number as a high number, which represents grazing, getting winged, all that kind of stuff. But God help you if they roll a 10 or a 12, because you probably have 10, 11, 12 health if you're lucky,
right?
And as we talked about last week, if you're down to 0, 1, or 2 health, like you're on the ground, like you're crawling, right? Like you're very injured. And if it's 0, you're out, you're dying. So it's serious. But as soon as you start stepping things up and you go to like, and I forget, I think they give shotguns a lethality rating, but as soon as you go to like a burst fire on a submachine gun or a burst fire on like an assault rifle, or you God help you, you're looking into the like large sniper rifle, 50 cal range kind of thing, these lose the damage die and it just has a lethality rating, typically 10%, 20%, 30%, something like that. And what that means when you roll, you're still trying to roll low. You're still rolling your percentile dice. If your lethality rating is 20 and you roll a 19, you kill your target. They're down. That's it. Right. If you don't roll lower than 20, you add the 2d10s because you're rolling percentile dice. You add the 2d10s together and it does that much damage. So on average, you're doing 11 points of damage. So they're brutal. As soon as like the higher end firearms come out, like when the dude's fast rope down from the helicopter with the night vision goggles and the M4s, like run, like they all can kill you or multiple agents in one go, because there are also rules depending on the length of the burst for how many targets they can cover. There's a lot of like little nuanced rules like that around automatic weapons that make them even more deadly. Is that what you were going after?
Yes.
Yeah.
But God,
yeah, I love these rules.
Do you know the rule for critical success on a weapon with lethality rating?
I don't think I do.
Oh, lethality rolls themselves cannot critically succeed or fumble. However, if the initial attack roll, right, is a critical failure or fumble, if it is a critical success, the lethality rating is doubled.
It's doubled?
Yes.
Nice. So, all right. So let's if you don't mind, let's walk through this.
Yeah.
Because what Sean's talking about, let's say you have a 60 in the firearm skill. Is that the right skill? I'm trying to remember.
Yeah.
He's saying that without knowing.
Sounds good.
We'll look that up too. Sorry, guys. Too many games in our heads. So you have a 60 and you roll 33.
Correct.
So Delta Green has that critical doubles or criticals, both bad and good, depending on whether you're below or above your skill rating, right? 33. And I think most of the lethality ratings are in the 10 to 20% range. I think 20 is pretty high. You're 10%. For your your MP5 would go to a 20, so it's doubled, so pretty nasty. Normally, I think damage is also doubled, isn't it?
The lethality rating is doubled. If that doubled lethality roll still fails, the resulting HP damage, the sum of the two dice, is doubled.
Yeah, yeah, you're so 4d10 basically.
Basically,
you're done. You know, you're done. So this is why, like we mentioned, like you don't want to get into these combats. Like if you outgun the other side, and you guys have all the kit and the tac gear and everything, you're in better shape. You can still take one in the head without, you know, put you down, but you'll have quite an advantage. But one of these sort of battles where both sides are heavily armed, it's a blood fest. It's terrible. Absolutely terrible.
There's an optional rule, I think, where if a handler prefers to roll traditional damage dice instead of using the percentile system, they can convert the lethality rating by rolling 1d6 of damage for every 3% of the weapon's lethality rating.
Yeah. There you go.
Booyah.
Crazy.
Yeah.
I like the lethality rating a lot.
Yeah.
It's cool. And remember as well, as brutal as it is, when you either get to zero hit points from losing, or zero health from losing, taking damage, or the lethality rating just says, just like that, you're down, right? You've caught a bullet and you're on the ground. There is the resuscitation thing. There's a whole like CPR, last minute save, paramedics arrive. There's that part of the game too. So it's not quite as brutal as like, you know, BX dead at zero. you know, like as soon as you take that last hit point of damage, you are stone cold dead. And you know, now you need a cleric to resurrect you.
Well, right? I think in Delta Green, yeah, you are at zero. Two is when you're down. Right.
Yeah. No. If lethality takes you to zero, you're in fact technically you're dead.
Yes.
But you can be brought back. Heart clear. Got beating again. That's what I'm getting at.
Yes. Yeah. Yes,
you're
yes.
dead. You're yeah. dead. But and if no one gets to you, you're dead. Dead.
You know? Right. Right.
You know.
Yes.
Not mostly dead. All dead. Anyway. Yeah. It's cool, man. It is cool.
Yeah. If your percentile roll is equal to or lower than the lethality rating, the human target instantly drops to zero hit points and dies.
There you go.
Yeah.
They're dead.
Yeah. And then, of course, with the lethality rating component, if you're like shooting an obstacle or something, that doesn't affect it the same way. It's really against an individual and armor and things of that nature. So for body armor, provides a protection against the lethality roll. But it does reduce the HP damage if the lethality roll fails.
Do you say the body armor does not affect the lethality rating?
It provides no protection against the successful lethality roll. Rating.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you got to still hit them, and then you got to roll.
That's still the, even though you have your vest on, sir, and in your helmet, sir, you caught one in the face.
Right? Yes.
Right. It's what that is.
Yeah.
Yep.
And then if a target is behind cover, the lethality roll automatically fails.
So you're only doing the add the 2d10s together, and then you probably take off the structure points or whatever they're called for whatever the cover is, right? If they're trying to shoot through it.
Yeah, it says the target simply takes the sum of the dice as HP damage, and then you minus the cover's armor rating from that.
That's it. That's what I'm going for.
Yep.
Yeah. Which is, again, pretty cool.
Yeah.
Depending on what your opponent is armed with, certain types of cover is not cover, right? Like if they have pistols, you can get behind a car and everything's fine. If they have rifles will go through major portions of a car or certain types of cover. Like if you're behind a concrete barrier, great. And I think that's kind of what this is kind of modeling, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
Pretty sweet.
Yeah, that's kind of combat in a nutshell. Now, somebody might write in and say, oh, dude, you totally missed this one component. But I think that kind of sums it up. You know, it's got to make sense. Like one thing, Harrigan mentioned a combat that had happened in a scenario that I was running, and it was all over the place. They were like kicking weapons out of people's hands and scrambling on the ground. Yeah. And like one person had another person in a chokehold. And it was all scrapping. It was like, what are they doing? Well, I'm going to do this. I'm going to dodge.
It was very visceral.
Yes.
It was.
Yeah. Fight back. And there's one behind a cover, and something, a cop arrives and he gets behind his door with a pistol. But then you got shooting into melee, which is like also a component of that. So it all kind of makes sense if you get this kind of in a nutshell and you think it through on what's happening in the moment, just like anything in a complicated combat scenario. you just, as a game master, have to narrate it, and the players have to understand what they're attempting to do at any given point, because they're either reacting to something that's happening to them, or they have their own turn in the initiative to act. And when you pin, well, then you got to do opposed rolls for keeping the pin. You know, essentially somebody's got you on the ground and you're on top of you or in the chokehold, then you're doing opposed rolls to break that out. So you can make this make sense very easily. If it's not spelled out in a step-by-step process, in my humble opinion. So
I found it did a great job supporting like an exciting action scene.
Yeah.
It felt like the opposite of picture, you know, old computer or video games where you have the two sides that line up on the left-hand side and the right-hand side, and they take turns shooting at each other. Like, it's so far from that. It's so much more integrated into the fiction you're describing. Like you said, like someone's coming at you with a pistol, a razor pistol, but you have better initiative. You can close the ground and fight back and disarm them if you win the fight back. And I think that's what happened. And then that turns into a scuffle, a physical scuffle. And then I think we hit the ground and we're doing the pins. Like, it's just very natural flow of how the combat sort of went is what I remember. And maybe it's not always like that, but I think if you have the right, everybody's got the right sort of attitude and vibe and thought process, you can make the combats pretty exciting in this game. And they're not slow. They're not going to drag you down. You're not going to be like, oh, here comes a 2-hour combat. Because as we described, it's just far too deadly for that to be the case, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Won't take that long.
No.
And maybe the little bookend here, recovery periods are long in this game. Like, if you're down to like 3 health, so in other words, you're not crawling, you're not on the ground, you have, like, you're going to be in the hospital. You've got, you know, if you want to heal quickly, the healing rates are not quick. So they take the injury part of it pretty seriously.
Yeah.
One thing I probably could have, I don't think there's a formal injury system or anything like a lasting injury kind of thing. You know, a lot of games are sort of bringing that to the fore these days. I'd like to see something like that in Delta Green. You can easily bolt on something where if you get down to 0, 1, or 2 hit points, you've got some kind of scar or permanent injury or something like that. There's things you could do.
Permanent injury. Anytime an agent is reduced to 2 or fewer hit points, they fall unconscious and make a con check or con times 5 test. So if the test fails, the agent sustains a permanent injury. So I thought there was one, but to your point, there are components of it. So for example, I don't know if it, like, you know, what does that mean? So if you got shot in the arm, then your arm is debilitated by all means. But the handler selects one of the agent's core statistics to permanently reduce by the number showing on the lowest 10-sided die of that roll down to a minimum score of 3. So you're going to automatically take 3 to the chin on one of those core abilities. So if you're like, you know, strength times 5 and you've got a 12 strength, well, and then it goes down to 9, strength goes from like 60 to 45. Boom. And then if the injury reduces the agent's strength or constitution, you must also permanently lower their maximum hit points accordingly, because those are hit points are derived from those stats, which is, I believe, the average, right, of those two. So some of the optional rules that's at the handler's discretion, instead of direct stat loss, a permanent injury can result in a specific physical trauma that cannot be corrected with surgery, and usually imparts in a permanent minus 20 penalty to related actions. So for example, you know, partially blinded, minus 20 on all things requiring sight. Partially deafened, minus 20 to all checks that require the sense of hearing. An arm or a hand, anything that uses your arms or hands could be at a minus 20. And then, of course, legs, same thing when it comes to movement. So that is, there's also a gritty combat trauma component. So if your handler is using that optional rule, more dangerous combat trauma rules, certain extreme injuries can also cause long-term conditions. So a severe concussion from a blow to the head could lead to permanent deep brain bleeding, resulting in permanent mental impairment. So you can even get into the mental capacities of an agent. And then similarly, a blast overpressure from explosives could rupture eardrums causing vertigo. So not even just deafness, but like dizziness and things of that nature. So yeah, it can get pretty crazy. But to Harrigan's point, I don't think there's like a list of these where you're like rolling and then determining, but it kind of whatever makes sense to the narrative.
Yeah. And I'm looking at it right now as well, the optional rule around it. So there's actually a few things here we don't need to dive into deeply, but there are also suppression rules for if you have automatic fire, that kind of thing, right? Healing is actually pretty cool where there's the resuscitation piece that I mentioned, which is the whole like if someone you can resuscitate a dead character. So the whole like either a lethality rating or they got to zero health, you can resuscitate them. But then there's rules for stabilizing, treating, recuperating. And this is just, it's very realistic. It's very grounded, which just gets back to that whole remember Sean and I have talked about before, like open the front door of your house and walk outside. And that is the Delta Green world with the underpinning of the, you know, the writhing cosmic horror beneath what you can see. This is just very similar. Like if you take a bullet in real life, that's what they're trying to model here is that that's, you know, you can be saved, but you also may have some hospital stays and you may have some permanent injury, which is modeled by the statistic damage or the attribute damage that Sean's talking about with the associated penalties. Last thing I want to say on this, Sean, I love the penalty system. We covered this, I think, a couple of weeks ago. But the fact that it's just plus 20, plus 40, minus 20, minus 40 makes it so easy to say, I aimed, but they're undercover, but I ran. You can just easily pile those together, get your number and roll it. There's not a lot of like plus 5, plus 10, and then a plus 5 from that. It's a quick resolution. The handling time is low for this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's what helped with the combat that I ran for you and the group. Now it's going on a couple of years, because you just kind of make sense of what it is, and sometimes it involves a dialogue like, "Oh, I think it would be this because I'm trying to do that." Oh, all right, that makes sense. Great.
There's not a lot of like, a little bit of rule book maybe flipping in the beginning when you're trying to figure out exactly how fight back works and what your options are and that kind of thing. But man, it comes to you quickly. You start to get it.
Yep. So that's combat in a nutshell, and there are some more nuances to it, but that's the high-level overview that I think will get you into the neck of the weeds of things and how we kind of enjoy it. It's simple and quicker to understand. I mean, you put a cheat sheet together, it's like, here are the actions you can take. Well, what can I do? And you got one action. Like, I think that's really huge. It's just not.
Do you have the older or the newer GM screen to either cover this well? Do you know?
I have the old one. I do not have the new one, and I don't know if they've changed anything to the new one.
Yeah.
But I have the old one, and it does break it. I think it literally, Harrigan copies the penalty chart and pastes it like from.
I can see that.
Yeah.
Those gray and white tables that are all through the book.
Yes, it's very much that way. And then I think it does. So, yes, it takes that table, which is pretty straightforward. The table we're referring to, folks, is in the agent handbook where it talks about, you know, if you're behind cover, minus 20. If you're, you know, doing a called shot, it's plus 20, I think it is for that. And it highlights some of those conditions.
Yeah. It's one of those funky things where I think, going back to, I don't know, early days of the hobby, it's weird to have so many rules of the game's rules in the agent's handbook when you get right down to it.
Yeah.
Like the whole combat system's in there. It's not in the handler's guide. It's in the agent's handbook.
Like all the rules are in the agent's handbook.
Yeah, that's what I mean. All the rules are in there. Yeah. It's like, I mean, I get it, but it's more like it's the core book.
It is.
With the agent stuff.
The handler's guide is just so full of flavor stuff setting.
It's more than just flavor, though. There's also spells, monsters.
There are, yes, you're right.
There's a bunch of stuff in there.
Yeah.
It's a good book.
Yes.
It's not all just fluffy.
That's true. A bunch. There's a lot, though. There is a lot.
Hundreds of pages, probably.
Yes, probably.
Yeah. All right, enough about combat.
Tradecraft.
Let's talk tradecraft. So the tradecraft part of this game is frankly why we feel like we can talk about it on a podcast that's about espionage games. You know, some people have expressed, how come you guys are going to spend so much time on just the one game kind of thing? And it's not even really a pure espionage game. It's more of this cosmic horror kind of game. Well, Tradecraft features so centrally in Delta Green. It's like the dominating part of the game, maybe beyond the PC's relationships disintegrating and the cosmic horror that underpins everything, right? But the tradecraft part of it, if you're going to exist in this space in between like your home life and what the government or the program is wanting you to do, you've got to use tradecraft. So I want to spend a bit of time, Sean, sort of breaking down what do I mean by that and how does it apply to the game? The game has an appendix in the handler's guide, again, about where they break down some sort of categories of tradecraft. And they actually get very explicit with, hey, if you're going to try to follow somebody on foot, roll this, and they're going to oppose that roll with this. So there's very crunchy mechanical bits that you can get to. I mean, it's not, I shouldn't say it's crunchy, but it's very prescriptive. Stealth versus humint or, you know, that kind of thing. But first, I want to kind of lay a little bit of groundwork. So when you talk about tradecraft, you know, these are the techniques, means, methods. These are the things that agents and intelligence officers use to cover up their clandestine actions so that you don't know they're doing what they're doing, to either gather information, plant evidence, steal something, you know, that kind of thing, right? So all the core espionage stuff that we always talk about on the show is very present in Delta Green. This includes communications, like how do you avoid digital footprints? You know, as an agent in Delta Green, you're supposed to shun smartphones. You shouldn't have a modern car, really, with a GPS system that can be tracked. You can't send unencrypted emails or unencrypted comms of any kind. And one of the things that's kind of cool, and they get to this in the book, I'm not sure which one of the authors was getting into this, but there's a whole section on, or not section, but there's paragraphs of text on use codes, dead drops, brush passes, like these old methods for transferring information to communicate with people. And then the last one I like a lot is like make it a face-to-face meeting. Make it somewhere safe. And this is usually why in the beginning, your handler meeting with you somewhere sort of off the reservation is kind of a cool scene to set up, like what's the opera going to be, who's involved, what's going on. I don't love it. I see lots of people set those sometimes in like, and including it in the adventures, they'll set them in like an FBI office. And I'm like, nah, I don't think that would be in an FBI office, man. Put that in the abandoned railway downtown or the tenement building that's not occupied, or you know what I mean? Like someplace where you're not going to have the room is not bugged. No one's overhearing you. You've taken the care to get there unseen. It's all that kind of stuff. Know what I mean?
I know what you mean.
Okay, cool. So moving on from that, that's comms, right? There's also like, there's a lot of tradecraft around documentation. So this includes like false identities. The FBI or the NSA putting together sham task forces. Many of the operas you'll read about that are published include kind of a, you've got a cover of an FBI task force meant to investigate X, right? And they've got some specialists on the team. That's kind of a classic trope that Delta Green uses. And it includes, of course, as well, like any fake credentials that you might have. But when you get into false identities, that's more than just a fake credential. That is like if someone does a background check on you, you show up as this other person, right? And they, for all intents and purposes, depending on how deeply they dig, you look like a real person. Your false identity, more than just a plastic card with your picture on it kind of thing, right? But this also, there's tradecraft around how you destroy and erase sensitive docs, now how you have to do that, like the cleanup aspect of it. And there's also a whole thing around falsifying reports. One, and cleaning up after an incursion if there may be some materials left behind. One of the parts that I don't know that when you see Delta Green actual plays or the games that I played myself, I don't know if we focused enough on like the whole tail end of the operation where there's this whole like clean it, make sure no one can, no, a report for a reporter arrives, you're not going to find evidence. If the police detective comes to the hotel room where it all went down, they shouldn't be able to find evidence of what happened, right? All that stuff is in this as well. And documentation can play a big part of that where you either have to burn the docs or collect them or redact them or whatever. I would also say, and this is another piece that I'd like to have more experience with, the whole thing, Sean, where someone gets exposed to the unnatural who was on the outside. And at the end of the op, you're supposed to approach them and do the whole like, so tell us what you know. Tell us what you think you're going to do. And this is a ramp towards onboarding that person as a friendly, onboarding that person as a Delta Green agent, or letting them know that, like, you know, I saw where your daughters go to school. And if we see that you publish anything about this, you know, that would be sad, right? Like dark stuff you can get into. But that also includes publishing false documents and incriminating evidence. Like there's all, again, this is where the tradecraft comes in, where you can discredit someone even if they go public and say, I saw these tentacles come out of my sink and grab my wife and pull her in, right? Well, if that person is on social media posting about that, the first thing you might do is try to discredit them before you eventually figure out how to get them quiet permanently, right? That sort of thing. Cool stuff. Have you had much experience with those sorts of scenes?
Not as much as I should. And I think it's because of those four tenets that Delta Green is based off of. I think there's elements when we get into a game where it's like, oh, you're going to, we're going to blow this up, right? Everything's blow everything up.
Burn it down, blow it up.
And some of the things I think with tradecraft, and I just want to mention this, which is a little cool, like you touched on it earlier. I am not an FBI agent. I am not a CIA, I'm not a CIA operative. And when we talk about embracing Delta Green, it can be very difficult to be like, well, these guys just don't know what they're doing as players, and then conveying that through their characters. And there are some reference sheets like Axioms. And then there's another one that I think Vince might have done from Black Gaming Project or Black Project Gaming that had to do with like, here's how an investigation works and what you should do as a standard. Like, if a detective showed up to a crime scene, this is what
what do they do?
What are they looking for?
What's the SOP? What's the standard operating
procedure? Exactly, the SOP. Right. Yeah. And on top of that, the reason I bring this up is because the players don't know what they don't know. And one of the things as GMs in this game that may come in handy is somebody like Jeff would be like, dude, I'm an FBI field operative. I would know that this is part of my deal. Come on, Sean. And I think as handlers, if we are really rooted into that system and understanding that better, Jeff has a case for sure. And I think we have to understand that, well, you didn't stipulate that, right? You never said you wiped down the place, Harrigan.
Yeah, right.
Well, I would know that. So let's make the roll. Right? Like then, you know, maybe it's a negotiation. Ah, that makes sense. Or if there's a role that needs to be done with a particular skill check. Because one of the things I think that is downplayed in Delta Green, at least in my experience and how I run games, is like, dude, these guys are getting away with tons of stuff.
That's part of it.
Yeah.
That's part of it.
Yeah.
There's also the way that some folks play, there's sort of a second cleaner team that comes in when you're done. And like, that shouldn't be the case. Like, it's meant to be a dirty job, and they don't have enough manpower to send some separate team and expose that other team to the thing that you were supposed to handle. You're supposed to handle it cradle to grave,
yes. Right?
Is the way that I'd like to play it.
Agreed. And then you start getting into some nuances that I don't know if a lot of players really, you know, jam on, or even handlers jam on, which is like, you know, let's say, for example, they're going to blow up a building. I don't know, somewhere in some scenario.
And, that never happened.
Right. Never happens. But say they're going to. Well, how do they do it? Well, they get gasoline. Great. Then they get, you know, 5 gas cans. Okay, great. How are you going to pay for all that stuff? And there are elements.
Cash, credit card. Yep.
And it says, is it funded by the program? Check. Not check. Or is it done by the agent? Like, I take it as out of my personal credit card. Great. Then what happens is when you go back to your bonds and your spouse goes through the credit cards and says, how come you bought like $2,000 at the local farmers co-op for fertilizer? What is that about?
Right.
And your bonds get reduced from that as a mechanical component, which is also outlined. So not to steal all of Harrigan's thunder, but it is like a really... like, I don't know if we really get into the weeds as much as we need to on some of this component of the game.
Well, let's put it this way. Let's take what everything you just described. It ties back into this, like, are you any good at tradecraft? Because if you're not, your wife will see what you're doing. Your boss will see what you're doing. The cops will be like, you know, they're at your door. Like, oh, we got your license plate on the CCTV camera down the street. And you know what I mean? So if you don't take these steps, you're accelerating your demise is what you're doing.
For
whether
sure.
it's where you're burnt out on all your bonds and you're now insane because of, or because of somebody catches up with you that shouldn't, or whatever. Like, if you don't use these tradecraft things, things can get pretty bad, right? And I do think it's amusing, the whole, like, you know, Jeff was a detective, because I think, I know this other guy, Fred, was a current police detective.
Right.
And most of us don't have that benefit of knowing how, you know, this isn't my day job. So it's one of the reasons why maybe that I'm okay with the BRP system being so skill heavy as it is, because you lean into that trad structure of, I don't know, I roll forensics. Okay, cool. I don't know how forensics really work on a crime scene, and neither do you. So let's lean on the game mechanism to get us there, right? And it can be the whole, like, you got a 40, you got a 50. Ah, you just do it. Or what I would probably do is along the lines of, you got a 40 or a 50, I'll give you these three things, roll, and maybe we'll see what else you can learn if you can succeed, that kind of thing, right? So it's all right there for the taking. It's cool. Keep going on tradecraft. I just want to run through sort of the big picture items here. There's a lot of tradecraft around crime scenes themselves. So the sanitizing of, like, blood, evidence, cosmic spooge. Like there's so much stuff that's probably in the room that you need to clean. You know,
and ooh, don't fire up that ultraviolet light. Whoa,
exactly. Not let the scientists or the forensics experts come in and find. There's a lot of that goes on in a crime scene. You have to dispose of bodies. And the book is hilarious. The book, the Agent's Handbook, has this, like, cut it up into small pieces and bury them separately in the woods. Fill the bathtub with acid. And, like, there's these very explicit.
Take a note from Breaking Bad. Yes.
Yes. There's these very explicit ways to dispose of bodies. It's pretty funny.
Yeah.
And then just kind of rounding out on the tradecraft side of things, there's all the stuff that's classic around surveillance, losing tails, following people without being seen, bugging their rooms, putting wiretaps in, finding those things that have been done to you, you know, those sorts of things. And then the sort of the classic stuff that Jeff or my friend Fred would do is, like, how to find someone. Like, you know, and I'm talking about you see them and you're following them through the street, but rather following their credit card receipts, following their last known address, interviewing their neighbors, like all that crap as well, right? That's all tradecraft. That's all, like, bring in how you do the job and get to that next sort of piece of the puzzle, that sort of thing, right? And then there's also a whole piece. This is kind of cool because it's in Last Things Last. There is a forensic accounting practice that you'll go through. This is the whole, like, give me your tax records, open that filing cabinet, and you can pour through there and figure out, oh, he's got a second home. Oh, he's got, look at these credit card receipts. The guy has a girlfriend on the side, and we can contact the girlfriend, right? Like, all, like, again, it's just where, like tradecraft is like bright light in your face that if you use it the right way. You don't have to be an expert in this stuff. You just have to be able to, like, wrap the mechanics around it so you can kind of, you know, mobilize these ideas, I guess. And then the last piece is all of the, what Delta Green calls human, but all the people stuff. Being a social chameleon, being able to integrate yourself into someone's social circles if you're playing the long game, right? Being able to groom or cultivate informants and agents. So kind of the creepy side of this, where you're not telling them the whole truth, you're gaslighting them, etc. And then finally, there's, like, a whole, like, psych profiling thing as well, where, you know, there's tradecraft around understanding people's motivations and what their backgrounds tell you about them and all that kind of stuff. So just without even going into the, like, the book's chapter on tradecraft, that's why I think the game is the topic for Go Bag, is because of all this stuff. But what do you think?
Yeah, agreed. And going back to, you know, the character sheet and some of the skills, like you were saying, is, like, that's why I think it's important in this game to just literally look at your character sheet and see what you can do, which is a little odd. Like, some games you're like, all right, let's put the character sheet aside. What are you doing? Tell me what you want to do and we'll figure it out. But, you know, don't look at your skills. It's just a skill list. Well, in this game, it can absolutely help. Like, accounting, boring. Why do I got accounting on this thing? This is really dumb. Well, accounting goes to tracking all the numbers and documents and tax records and receipts and all that. And not only that, but manipulating them, forging, you know, potentially forging them.
Exactly. Right? If you're planting information or making someone look bad in front of his boss or whatever, right?
Yes.
All that stuff.
Yes. Yep. You know, expense records. Oh, I would know that they're going to look at this for an expense record. I got to change that or, you know, adjust it. But even going back to like requisitioning stuff, like how many times have we run this game where the agents, well, I'll just get that from the program. Or I'll get it from the department, whether they are funded well or not. If you run that and you roll a bureaucracy check, even if you make a formal request, then they can give it to you. How that's a, there's a paper trail. Things are being filled out in triplicate. And so how does that,
yep.
What is listed on those forms? And, you know, and what does that, how does that work?
And I would say a failure can manifest either immediately. No, you can't have that. Or...
Right.
Here it is. And during your next home scene, you get a visit from the internal auditor.
Right. Internal audit. Like, right.
Yeah. Like there's, oh, Joe, man, there's so many cool ways to take this game. And when you combine everything that we've been talking about the last like three episodes, probably when you put it together as a whole, I don't know. It's pretty cool, Sean. I would say like on the, because you put your finger on something I think that's key here. This is so far from an OSR game that is like about player skill, where you don't look at your sheet and you instead just, you take in everything the GM is describing, you apply your own knowledge, you make smart decisions, you investigate kind of in cool ways by asking questions. You can't mimic all of these things by doing that, which is why you have these skills. So ripping them off quickly, I would say like there's an accounting skill, an art forgery skill for making IDs and whatnot, bureaucracy, computer science, criminology, disguise, forensics, human, law, persuade, search, SIGINT, stealth, everything I described like 10 minutes ago or the last 15 or 20 minutes or whatever, these are the skills that you're using to do all that stuff, right? And then there's this also this kind of cool thing, which we've talked about briefly before around special training. And this is where you don't get a rating in the thing, but you basically have a box you can check. Yeah, I know how to pick locks. I have a lock picking training. I have not only do I have a law skill that gets a rating, I also have expertise in foreign law and criminal code. So if I'm in Canada or Mexico or the UK, I know the legal system. So there's these special things you can kind of add to your skills around electronic security, around, this one's kind of cool. This came right from the book. You can even have conspiracy or group knowledge. So if you study a cult or study a fringe group you're worried about, the GM's just going to give you information because you know that stuff. So you can know who the players are. You can know where their compound is, like all that kind of stuff. Just pretty cool stuff. To close this out, Sean, I'll talk briefly about the materials that start on page 165 in the agent's handbook, which is all the much more sort of granular view of escaping from a tail and planting a bug. It gives you these tables, two pages of tables, and then a set of descriptions that go with those that tell you what they mean. And these include going unnoticed, creating false identities, surveilling by planting mics and decrypting comms, pursuit, breaking and entering, sneaking past security, covering your tracks, searching and arresting people, interrogation, evidence tampering, et cetera. So there's some really specific things that are in the book it's worth a peruse. And then the final thing that is also in that same chapter, and maybe doesn't get the call out that it should. And I actually went through, Sean, and looked in detail in the agent's handbook. I looked at the index and I did searches in the PDFs, agent's handbook and the handler's guide. They don't do a great job getting into the green boxes in like gory detail. They are referenced. There's some sections that describe them in a good way. But speaking of tradecraft, like there are these locations that the program has all over the country, probably all over the world, which are meant to be drop boxes and pickup boxes for the agents that are used like in the moment when you need them. So in other words, if the handler needs to get specialized gear to the agents, they're probably going to use a green box. It's the preferred way of doing it. This is a storage container that's been rented for 20 years from somebody. It's a property they own that has a locked trunk in the basement. It's a, you name it, the green box is meant to be this sort of, and this is the part that's so cool, quasi-mysterious, like what the hell is in the box? Like when you open up the green box to get your gear, there may be things that other agents put in there from prior missions. There may even be, we've talked about how the, maybe not in detail yet, but we talked about the different eras on Delta Green where you have the formal program shuts down in the, I think, early 1970s, runs as the Outlaws till the mid-90s, and then the mid-90s some other things start to happen where they're trying to get organized, and then the new program starts in the early 2000s. These different groups, the Outlaws, still have access to some of those green boxes. They still know where some of them are, or they may have their own. So there's just, and these green boxes, as you can picture, might contain like a mask or a book that no one should have, right? Like if we're talking the cosmic horror angle. So I don't know. It's a combination of where the tradecraft part of this, where you're communicating, you are able to give items to people, essentially like a customized dead drop sort of thing through this mechanism. But the mechanism can introduce all sorts of horrible complexity. Oh, why is there a folded up body in this green box? And why is it my best friend? the guy I went on the last mission with is right. Another Delta Green guy that I like, and he's in the box. There's so much good stuff.
He's you can do. In the box. Yes. Write that down. Ooh, that's a good one.
Yep.
But all great stuff. But, you know, somebody would say, why? Why do I got to cover all this up? What's the big deal? And then who is going to even find out? And then you get into Delta Green and the consequences of not being able to successfully pull all this off. And there is mechanics around prosecution.
Yeah, we covered that last week.
Yeah,
it was great.
And so yep. There is those components. And then, you know, if you get prosecuted, you lose sanity, your bonds go sideways, and it's a mess.
And you can get fired, which also hurts your sanity and your bonds.
Yes, on top of it.
Yeah, it's this horrible vortex.
Yeah, you could literally have a campaign around one operation. And then one, like something very simple, and then it goes sideways. And if you don't make the right rolls and all that, and then it just one thing after the other.
You know, you can also start to wire some of this together, Sean, with what we talked about last week around bonds. And you recall that I have long struggled with, you know, do I reflect any of the bond damage in the moment, or do I wait to see the scene later? And typically it's just wait to see the scene later, right? Well, if you can tie that into some of your like failed tradecraft things, those can appear just like you're talking about where your spouse is like, what were you doing in Zurich? I thought you were going to be in New York City. Like, you know what I mean? Because of the credit card bill or immigration has contacted her for whatever reason, because you failed a role or didn't, not even just a role, but you just didn't, you know, think to like dot the I or cross the T. That all can come rushing back into this other part of the game, the home scenes, the bonds, your sanity, and all that sort of stuff. So it's not literally just you were noticed, but you were noticed, and which is what you're talking about, like the repercussions, the consequences of all this, right?
Yeah, and on top of that, so having, you know, with that component, it's like it is a game that was created back in the 90s as a supplement to Call of Cthulhu. And, you know, people are talking about failing forward, and it's not fail forward. I don't think is even mentioned as a phrase in Delta Green, the game, no. Because it came out before it was very popular and in a lot of Powered by the Apocalypse games as a mantra. And with Delta Green, it's like in spades because you may not be doing it in the moment, and they fail. So they may not even fail what they're trying to achieve, but the fact that they failed the forensics piece means they forgot to wipe their fingerprints off the doorknob. And during an investigation, 100%. They said, well, that's fine, but my fingerprints aren't on file. And I go, huh, were you in the military? Not right. Only are your fingerprints on file, you're probably DNA is on file. Like,
yep, yep.
You know.
And this is just where I think handlers have to get. Failure doesn't mean the door closes.
Correct.
Right? It yes. Doesn't mean that that's end of scene. It can mean that the coroner is like, okay, I'll let you into the basement to see the body. And then he goes and makes a phone call right away while you're looking at the body. So you get to look at the body, but, you know, the men in blue now arrive or who whatever. It doesn't have to be that dramatic, but you know what I mean? Like there's so many angles to take. For what what you're getting at is that you didn't get the outcome you wanted, which was let us inspect the body unaccosted, and you're not going to bug us anymore, and you're not going to introduce any issues. Well, here comes some issues. This is a way to look at it, right? There's just so much you can do with it. You're right. The game was not written at a time when people were thinking as clear-headedly as they are now about these things, right? But right. There's no reason you can't apply that stuff.
Man, an agent's life is a freaking mess. And sometimes I look at it and think of the group I'm running for. I'm like, they're getting off way too easy. Like, yeah, dealing with an upset spouse as a bond is one thing. Like, oh, you missed the person's birthday, but there's so much more hurt that you can put on player characters. Now, of course, you got to be careful that you're not just dropping the hammer on their head every single moment of every single game of every single session. But there is a lot of things that just like, oh, my God, now I got to deal with this, man.
I don't think the GM needs to be adversarial or needs to be like out to get the players.
Correct.
Because the system does that. Their own actions are going to do that. And the horrible situations they're put in are all going to do that. You're going to get that anyway, right? Just let it happen. Let those bonds dwindle. Like you say, you're going easy on them kind of thing. There's no reason why it can't build to build to a head. And suddenly the pressure releases though, right? And you come home and your wife's gone. Like she left you. Didn't even say, there wasn't a lot of like, you know, a lot of fighting and a lot of like back and forth on this isn't working. It's just like, you know what? I give up. That's enough. I'm going to live with my sister, you know, that kind of thing.
Right. So. My argument is I don't know if I give enough checks around that just to see.
Yeah.
But and I think to your point, like getting the mechanics in there so that you can, that can or could not happen. And I think sometimes I just, it's out of sight, out of mind, and it's only this one thing when it's very much multiple components if the situation presents themselves.
So, yep. Yeah. So summing up, I'm not sure if you have more to cover on this, but summing up from my side, I would say without tradecraft, like you can't complete the operations in a way that you'll be around for more than one or two operas. Like you can't. You have to hide evidence. You have to hide your traces. You have to misinform people. You have to lie to people. It's all this stuff, man. And it's good. It's so good. What do you got to say about that?
That's it, man. That's all. That's it. I don't have anything else to say.
All right. Our Delta Green journey continues.
It does indeed. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. On behalf of Harrigan and myself, thanks, and we'll catch you on the next one. This episode of Go Bag, produced with help from the following friendlies, field operatives, special agents, and black ops directors: Joe Swick, Roger French, Merkel Froelich, Tony Sugarloaf Baker, Polish Ogre, Hoos Carl, Farty McButterpants, Laramie Wall, Eileen Barnes, Hep DeLima, Aaron Relia, Wayne Peacock, Jeff Walken, Yorkus Rex, Eric Salzwedel, Phil McClory, Jason Hobbs, Michael Holland, Remy Bilodeau, Crystal Eggstad, Eric Avia, Bornak, Brian Kurtz, Chad Glayman, Jim Ingram, Orcus Dorcas, Chris Shorb, Brian Rumble, Victor Wyatt, Kevin Keneally, Andy Hall, Jason Weitzel, Salt Hart, Tad Lechman, Nicholas Abruzzo, Matthew Catron, Curtis Takahashi, Angela Murray, Mr. White 20, Jason Connerly, Shannon Olson, Ryan West, Kristen McLean, Larry Hollis, Len Seal, Jake at Faded Quill Gaming, Tess Trekkie, Tim Jensen, Nubis, Christopher Lang, Qualog, Peter Skanes, Wendy Forcon, James, Fraser Ronald, Dirigible, Chaplain Grimaldus, and Mark Mekes. Thank you, operatives. This transmission is audio only, but if you want the full dossier, GoBag is on YouTube. Video episodes, deeper dives, all of it. Your next mission, youtube.com/@GoBagPod.